This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Okay, everybody, welcome to the People Speak radio show. This, again, is your fill-in host, Charles Giuliani, still filling in for Basima. And this evening we've got two guests, two very important guests. Ellen Brown, some of you may know, she's the author of, Web of Debt was her first big popular book dealing with the Federal Reserve. I understand you have a new book, too, that's come out more recently, don't you, Ellen?
I have a new book, but it hasn't come out yet.
Okay.
It's virtually done.
All right. Well, we'll be watching for that. But Web of Debt is her, the one that put you on the map, I guess you could say, right? That's quite a popular book, quite an eye-opener. And our other guest, very interesting, for those that haven't seen her yet, if you go into YouTube and type her name in, Victoria Grant, she's a 12-year-old Canadian girl who gave a long speech about our banking system, the way it functions or doesn't function, I should say, and how we need to get away from it and set ourselves free from its clutches. It's brilliant. It's something I haven't seen the likes of from any full-grown adults, and here's this 12-year-old girl. So I guess first my question would be to you, Victoria, where did you learn all this stuff? Was it your mom, your dad, or both?
It was my dad. He's been researching this for a while, so he got me started in all this.
Wow, that's great. I understand your mom is the principal at your school?
Yeah, she's part principal and also my teacher.
Oh, she teaches you too? Wow, that's funny. Now, yeah. Is she into this at all? Does she know much about this, or does she leave it up to your dad?
A little bit.
Well, this isn't something she can probably talk about in school, though, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I was pretty floored when I saw your presentation. I'm like, if I remember, you weren't even using notes, right? It was all off the top of your head?
Yeah, it was all from memory.
Wow, that's really impressive. I couldn't do that myself. I'll tell you what, I want to get to talk to Ellen, too, here in a moment, but could you give us maybe a short segment of that speech so people can get an idea of your vast knowledge of this subject? It's you think you could condense it maybe in a minute or two?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, go for it.
So basically my speech is on the corrupt banking system, and like the government is borrowing money from private banks, which is not right, because when they borrow from the private banks, they are charging the people of Canada compounded interest, which really doesn't make sense. So why would the government be doing this to us? Like, it doesn't make sense.
There's no need for it. Doesn't serve us any purpose, does it?
Yeah.
Ellen, I think you got some competition.
I know. She boils it down really well. Well, and what's so great about the whole Canadian model, she was talking about the fact that the Bank of Canada issued, or the Bank of Canada borrowed from the Bank of Canada from 1939 to 1974, basically funding its government interest-free. And during that period, amazing things happened. They did seaways and roadways and the healthcare system. They put up in a brilliant healthcare system. It's not so good now because they're heavily in debt, and so they've had to cut back like everybody's doing. But they proved the model. For 35 years, the government was borrowing directly from their own bank, which, of course, was just issuing the money on its books the same way that the Federal Reserve does quantitative easing.
Minus the interest.
But it was all interest-free.
Right.
We actually do borrow some from the Federal Reserve, but it's only maybe 10% of the debt, And all of the rest we borrow privately, so we're paying interest on it. So the question is, why? Why don't we borrow it all from the central bank like they showed you could do without creating inflation, without creating all those horrible things that everybody thinks it would lead to?
Right. And as I'm sure you know, Victoria, it's not just up in Canada you got that problem. It's going on here. It's going on in a lot of other places around the world, too.
Yeah.
It's nonsense. I don't imagine the Federal Reserve has invited you to come speak before them, have they?
No.
I don't think they will either. Nor you, Ellen.
No, but they might have seen Victoria's speech. I mean, 2.5 million, it's gotten 2.5 million hits on YouTube.
No kidding. I'm not surprised. Yeah, that's astonishing. Once again, folks, just go to YouTube and just type your name in, right, Victoria? To find it? Yeah. Just type in Victoria Grant. Somebody had sent it to me in email. Oh, it was about a month ago. And I'm like, wow. Can we get her to run for president? That's truly great. That's fantastic. How long have you known about this stuff, Victoria?
Well, I just started learning about, like, the beginning of this year.
Really? Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, about, like, 6 months ago.
Well, keep studying. You're going to be dangerous in a few more years. You're already dangerous now. Yeah. That's really great. What do you think? Are you going to go into banking someday?
Well, I want to be an interior designer, actually. I'm going to study this on the side.
I hear you. Yeah, you don't want to get into that. That can be pretty scary, right? You don't want to change it from within. Change it from outside. Hopefully get people to wake up. And, well, you know, what we need, Ellen, what do you think? Should we be following Iceland's model?
Well, I would certainly say that Greece should be following Iceland's model.
Yeah.
Rather than paying exorbitant interest rates to outside creditors, they should just walk away from their debts and issue their own national currency and get the economy rolling again. And that it's Iceland's done it, but so has Argentina. So have a lot of countries. You don't hear much about them, but the ones that actually default and just start issuing their own currencies do much better than the ones that continue to try to bear this crippling debt owed to foreign creditors. If it's owed to themselves, it's not so bad. Like, theoretically, Japan has a crippling debt, but it's really not crippling them. They're still, like, the fourth largest economy in the world and one of the world's major exporters, because they owe their debt to themselves. They owe it to the Japanese people, but it's through the Japan Post Bank, which is a publicly owned bank, and through the Bank of Japan, which is mostly publicly owned and
of course,
definitely publicly controlled.
We used to be that way for the most part, you know, essentially, you know, prior to the Federal Reserve, 1913. That's why, you know, the Civil War debt, for example, was easy to pay off, minus interest. It was a debt owed to ourselves.
Right.
And like Victoria so well puts it, it just doesn't make any sense at all. The only people our current system benefits is the big banks, the big, you know, money lenders. It doesn't do anything for us, our government. Everybody loses except the bankers. They're the only ones that win in this game. And what function does this serve? None.
Mm-hmm. Now they've turned, you know, they were using the word austerity, which sounded like that we all have to tighten our belts in order to pay off this crippling debt. And now they've changed it to fiscal cliff because austerity sounded too much like we were wearing the hair shirt and sacrificing. Fiscal cliff sounds like it's really scary, so we have to do something about it. But the thing is, the debt is really not a problem. We've had a federal debt. We in the United States have had a federal debt ever since 1835, and we've been like the biggest economy in the world for a good portion of that time. It didn't really hurt us. What hurts is the interest, and you don't need to pay interest if you borrow from your own bank. Then you get the money back. The theory is that if you borrow from your own bank, you're creating inflation, because it's just creating the money on its books. But we know that all banks create the money on their books. So if you're paying to privately, which ultimately comes from a private bank, then you're paying unnecessary interest.
Yeah, they're literally creating money out of nothing through fractional reserve banking, and then they turn around and charge interest. They'd be making out like bandits even without the interest. But when you add that factor in, it's unbelievable. I mean, they don't lose. Again, they're not even really lending anything out. It's just entries, you know, on a keyboard, essentially.
Well, they do have to balance their books. So when the checks leave the bank, they have to pull it from the reserves. So in that sense, it zeros out. But it's the interest.
But wouldn't have to wonder, though, the fact the Federal Reserve has never been audited, how much balancing are they actually doing? Does anybody really know?
Well, and it's the big banks that are creating most of the money anyway. It's not the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. IMF, World Bank, and so on. Yeah. Oh, for that matter, have they ever been audited?
Well, that's the problem. To the extent that you can audit them, you don't really know that you're seeing it all.
Right.
That's another many arguments for making the whole system be a public utility. There to serve the public with a mandate to serve the public and run by public servants who don't get bonuses, fees, commissions. There's nothing in it for them except their salary.
I marvel that there was an interview with Greenspan back in September of, I think it was 08 or 09. And I think it was McLehrer, you know, the PBS NewsHour there with McLehrer. And he asked him, he says, Mr. Greenspan, who in Washington overawes the Fed? You know, who does the Fed answer to? All of a sudden, he starts laughing. He's got this sinister grin on his face. He says, well, quite frankly, that question is moot because nobody overawes us. We do what we want, and everybody follows in line in Washington. Basically, that, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but that was his answer. Nobody. We don't answer to anybody. That should have made people's jaw drop. I wonder how many people actually paid attention and caught that, the significance of that.
Well, it was set up to be independent on the theory that you don't want it to be influenced by politics. But politics is us. In other words, if our elected representatives don't have any influence on our central bank, the central bank is, like you say, it's nobody's controlling it, and nobody can see what they're up to, and nobody can control what they're up to.
Sure. Victoria, I'm curious, you know, obviously this video has made you kind of famous up there, right? I bet you got a lot of people that are coming up to you. Hey, aren't you that girl in the video?
Yes.
How about,
well, we went to Starbucks one time, and there was this guy who works for a business. I can't remember what it is, but he was like, hey, aren't you that girl in the YouTube video? And I was like, yeah, and he's like, I use your video all the time for where I work. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, you become a celebrity. Now, your friends at school, are they talking to you about this? Do they ask you any questions, or how's that going?
It's pretty good. It's kind of like died down in our school, like,
yeah.
But sometimes they're like, so where are you going now, and stuff like that.
Does your social studies teacher, do you have social studies up there? Is that what they call it, or just your history teacher?
Well, we have history and geography, and that's my mom.
Oh, she teaches that class. Okay, because I was going to ask if your teacher, you know, asks you not to bring that up in class, but if it's your mom, I guess you don't have to worry. That's funny. That's kind of neat, having your mom both as your principal and your teacher, huh?
Yeah, it's good.
That's pretty cool. Ellen, I bet you didn't get an early start like Victoria, huh?
No.
You know, I don't even think I ever asked you. How did you get involved with studying into the Federal Reserve and seeing it for what it is and exposing it?
Actually, I did. I was an English major at Berkeley. I got my first degree from Berkeley, and I wanted to write, and so I researched everything that interested in me, and that was one thing with the Federal Reserve. But at that time, it was before the Internet, and you just couldn't find the answers. You know, you could think through a question, and then you'd go to the library, and the book would be out, or the book just didn't say. But then decades later, when the Internet became available, it's just suddenly all those numbers were there, and you could start putting it together and putting the puzzle pieces together, and you could see what was going on. So the internet's just been an amazing thing. I mean, it's
sure.
The whole, like, even like Occupy Wall Street, the whole idea that people now know that Wall Street is the problem here. It used to be that when they controlled the media, we didn't have a way of knowing what was really going on.
So we need to take advantage of this while it still lasts. I'm sure they're probably trying to...
Yeah, that is an issue.
Yeah, they're scratching their heads trying to figure out how can we get rid of that thing.
Yeah.
Definitely. It's woken a lot of people up to a lot of things. It's a really good resource for as long as it lasts. How do you feel about, I'm sure you've heard of people like, G. Edward Griffin. He wrote the Creature from Jekyll Island. Are you familiar with his work? Or?
I am, and I don't actually agree with his solution, but I thought his book was great. And
yeah, I wanted to ask you, that's where I was going with that. How does your solution differ from his?
Well, he would have an all-gold currency, which I just don't think can work. There's not enough gold in the world. First of all, let's assume you're going to turn all your dollars into gold. What are you going to buy the gold with? Because dollars aren't going to be good anymore. To me, it's just a totally unworkable solution.
I have to confess, after reading his book, I thought that was the solution. But as the years have gone on, I don't see the wisdom in that anymore myself either.
Yeah, but he had some really good information in there.
Oh, sure.
And it was his previous book, World Without Cancer, that actually got me interested in this whole field in my old, more mature years. before that, I was writing on health and the politics of health and the pharmaceutical cartel. And World Without Cancer linked up the pharmaceutical cartel with the banking cartel and showed that where they got their power was from the power to create money.
Right.
So then I realized if I wanted to have an impact, I had to go for the jugular, which was the power to create money.
Right. Yeah, that's quite a thing. That's another whole story. But it is intimately connected with this discussion, the whole medical establishment, the AMA. You look back from the earliest days, they were engaged in complete shysterism. There's no other way to describe it.
It was literally, Rockefeller's grandfather was literally a snake oil salesman.
Sure. They had nothing to do with health, just money.
Yeah.
Much like our modern medical establishment. It hasn't changed much, has it? It's really sad. But anyway, that's another whole story.
I loved about Victoria's presentation, though, is that she managed to... Yeah, I mean, the reason that it's not so popular is everybody thinks they can't understand it. Like, economics is just too heavy, and it's been made purposely difficult so that we all think, well, we'll just leave it to the experts because we can't get it. So
right.
Here we have this brilliant 12-year-old that just...
stripped it of all its mystery.
Emperor has no clothes thing. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. You actually have the potential, Victoria, to reach people, and I'm sure you've already realized that. You can get the truth out to people in a more powerful way than adults can.
Yeah. And like what you said before about them, we can't understand this. It's going to be way above our heads. It's like, just take the 5-6 minutes out of 5-6 minutes out of your schedule and like watch the video. You never know. You could end up, you could end up getting information.
Right. No, that's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, what's the excuse? If you, a 12-year-old, can understand it all, although I think you have a higher IQ than a lot of adults I know, but nevertheless, you know, if a 12-year-old can figure this out, anybody should be able to. And that's really what confuses people. They think... I'll leave that up to the experts. The experts know. But the experts who have been running the thing have been making a mess of everything, haven't they?
I don't know, but I still have a lot to learn, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're never done learning. You're always, keep reading, Victoria. You're always going to be learning more. The more you dig, you're going to realize. I always say a really intelligent person is one who can admit that he doesn't know everything. When someone says that they know everything, that's when they're at the peak of ignorance. You never reach a point where you know everything. But you're on the way, though. You're on the way to knowing everything. You're doing a really good job. I wish I knew, at your age, the stuff that you know now. Good heavens.
Yeah, and it's good that you're not planning it for your day job, too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, actually.
You can do a lot more on the sidelines if you have another source of income.
Yeah. If you go near a bank, just do the interior design of it or something. Do it over. Yeah. Stay away from those people as much as you can. Yeah, I understand you guys met recently in Philly. Was there some function there or something? Or?
Yeah, the Public Banking Institute.
We our first conference, and Mark Armstrong is the executive director, and he saw Victoria's video on the internet, and he said, "Oh, I must ask her if she would speak." And sure enough, she came down, and she was the star of the show. It was great.
That's great. Yeah, I think that's the one that I saw actually. Somebody had sent me. Yeah, that was fantastic. Great job. We got some questions coming in, but before I get to that, I had a couple other things that I wanted to cover here. I just lost my window. Where'd it go? Oh, okay, here it is. I wanted to ask you, Ellen, about your new book, what we can expect. Did you want to talk about that in any detail?
Here's my title. This is my working title, is The Buck Starts Here, Restoring Prosperity with Publicly Owned Banks. But the problem was I was just in Europe, and they didn't understand my title because the buck starts here is not a, it's an American colloquialism.
Oh, So
I might have to call it public banking, which is such a boring title, but maybe I have to do it just to. But it's all about public banking. And so it's sort of a web of debt was more about that the government should be issuing the money. I mean, we the people should be issuing the money, not the bank.
Right.
But public banking is how we the people would issue the money. You do it at a grassroots level by actually taking out a loan. That's the way banking works right now, is that it's really the people who create the money by monetizing your own promise to repay in the form of a loan. And the function of the bank is really just to check your credit and make sure that you're going to pay it back. And then if they collect interest, the interest should be a public, it should go back to the public. It should be a public benefit because it's we, the public, who are actually extending the credit to people who, they want to pay you with this little piece of paper, meaning that you can collect later. But so you're just trusting the system that you'll be able to collect later. So it's our credit, really, our public credit. It's not the bank's gold. It's our credit that's being lent.
Sure.
Yeah, so I go through the whole history of, it turns out there 40% of banks globally are publicly owned, and these are largely in the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which have 40% of the global population, and they also are the countries that escaped the credit crisis. And it's because of their public banking system. So I look at those countries and many other countries and at the history of public versus private. And the whole, there's a whole conspiracy theory thing. I mean, the cartel has been stamping out public banking wherever they could find it. Like Canada is a prime example. In 1974, Canada quit borrowing from its own central bank. Well, why did they do that? It was because Canada joined the Basel Committee, which is part of the Bank for International Settlements, and the Basel Committee's purpose was supposedly maintain the value of the currency. But what that means is you can't borrow from your own government, and you can't you can't borrow from your own central bank, and you can't issue your own money as a government, because the theory is that inflates the money supply and devalues the currency, but it doesn't. If a government issues money to pay for goods and services, it stabilizes the currency because you create goods and services in that way. That's how you allow goods and services to come into being. You have to have some money out there to pay for them. So
it's the only way to have genuine economic growth.
Yeah. You have to have the money first. In other words, you have to have credit first. You have to be able to pay your workers and materials before you have a product to sell in the market, and then the product is what you pay the credit back with, or the debt.
The banking system we have in place, it's pretty insidious, isn't it? Because it's not readily apparent right away. It takes some time before you realize what's going on. And as time has gone on, the reason people don't realize it is it's shocking how many Americans don't even understand that our central banking system is really privately run.
Yeah. Well, it is. Even though Victoria made it sound really simple, it's definitely got a lot of nuances to it. So you end up scratching your head. I mean, take this recent LIBOR scandal. There are 500 trillion derivatives out there. First of all, that's virtually an imaginary number. I mean, nobody can imagine what 500 trillion could possibly look like. And they're all based on LIBOR, which is a word that nobody's ever heard of until suddenly it's this big scandal. And then when you try to pick it apart, you know, who is hurt and who did it, it's all so, they changed the language. It's sort of like medicalese and legalese. Well, you've got Fed speak, and you've got words that are there to obscure, to keep you from seeing what's really going on.
Right. Well, we talked about your book and your upcoming book, Ellen. How about you, Victoria? Do you see yourself writing a book someday?
Probably not.
Oh, no? Well, you never know. When I was even in high school, quite a few years older than you, I would never have believed it if somebody told me I was going to be writing books someday. That was the last thing I was interested in. I hated history. I think I just barely passed at the skin of my teeth. I just hated it. I thought it was so boring. I wound up becoming a history major later in college. and you just never know where things are going to go.
Yeah, well, I may be doing another speech.
Oh, really? Where's this one going to be?
For my speech meet at school.
Oh, cool. Is it going to be recorded and put up on YouTube, too? Or
maybe.
We'll have to watch for that. You don't have a website, do you, where you have some of your work up? Or?
No.
No, just, well, YouTube, right?
Yeah.
She's on our website, Public Banking Institute.
Oh, cool. Now, is that something that you started, Ellen, I believe?
Yeah, well, it is. I'm the president. I started writing about public banking in 2008 after the credit collapse, and I got so much email that I couldn't answer it all, and so a friend said, well, why don't you set up a Google group, and then they could talk to each other. And we had this really active Google group for several years, and we went round and round on all these issues. And pretty soon, after a while, we decided that we understood it all and what was going on here, and then it was time to stop talking and start doing something. So,
excellent.
So we formed an institute and a website, and we have reps and representatives in different states that are all working toward legislation, and it's mostly just spreading information.
Sure. You got a website for that? Or?
Yeah, publicbankinginstitute.org.
Excellent. Publicbankinginstitute.org, folks. Go check it out. You can. Is there a membership fee? Or?
No. We're all volunteers, and we're just think it's a good idea. I mean,
it gets kind
of addictive. You know, you get kind of excited about it. And then for me, I keep... If I would quit writing articles, I might get this book done, but I just can't resist jumping
in.
Yeah,
I know what you mean. I get them all the time. You have them forwarded. I'm in your mailing list, so I get them. I'm like, wow, she's really...
Every week there's some shocking thing that comes along, and you think, oh, I must write about that.
Well, that's like me. I have a regular show that I do, and it keeps me pretty busy, so... I've got several more books I want to write one of these days, but right now I just don't have the time because I'm writing outlines for shows, doing a lot of research for that, which I really enjoy, but other things get put on the back burner because of it. This is just where I'm at right now, but I know what you mean. It's demanding. It's a lot of work. You don't just slap stuff together. You don't want to just ramble. I hate reading articles where the author is just rambling. I want to learn, new things. You know, I want every sentence to inform me of important information. And some authors, you certainly don't do that, but some authors just put me to sleep. And it's like, you're just trying to fill space, give me the real, like you do in your speech, Victoria. Everything in your speech is just hard hitting. It's fact after fact. Anybody who's listened to it is just amazed. Wow, she's got it down. You lay the whole thing out. You don't beat around the bush. It's great.
Yeah, thanks.
So you actually memorize that whole thing, or do you kind of just remember concepts and fill the words in as you go along, or?
No, I memorized the whole thing.
Wow, that's impressive. Yeah. It's what, 6 minutes, I think it was?
Yeah.
That's pretty good. You know, those days are gone. Kids today don't memorize anymore. They're not even encouraged to. Years ago, kids would have whole poems or whole chapters from a book, you know, that they would be able to recite. You don't see that too much anymore. So you're doing a good job. Keep going with that, because that's how you train your brain early to do that, and you're going to be able to make use of that, you know, later in life. It seems that if you don't do that when you're young, you know, you kind of lose it when you get old. You're not able to do it anymore. So you're on the right track. Your parents are doing a good job. What's that?
Like, at my school, we start, like, memorizing poems in grade 1, and then up to grade 4.
Oh, good.
At grade 4, we start doing speeches. And
wow.
So, like, from grade 1 to 8, we memorize poems and speeches.
Sounds like you've got a better school system than we have down here, or at least in my area anyway. They don't do that stuff anymore. That's good.
That's just what I was thinking, that the Canadian system, or at least is yours more, is it a private school?
Yeah, it's a private school in Guelph.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes a difference, too, the private schools.
Yeah, that sounds like a great system. Our school system is so bent on passing tests, which is so boring for the kids to have to learn these rote facts without getting to put them together.
And then, of course, happens is they wind up teaching to the test, so you're just going to learn, you know, what's on the test, and the teacher isn't really looking to bring other stuff in to supplement what's in the textbook, and the kids are getting ripped off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And public speaking is one of the most important things you can learn. I didn't, but my ex-husband thought the most important thing he did in school was debate, and so he made sure that our kids did, and they're both really good speakers. But I think that's something that's not emphasized, and it should be.
No, that's really good. So I take it you're not shy. Do you answer questions a lot in class? You speak in class, and Victoria?
Yeah,
I bet. That's good. When I was your age, I was so shy. I was always petrified I was going to be called on. I didn't want to talk at all. And here I am, a radio show host. I never thought that was going to happen either. It's funny. You change as you get older. But that's great. It's great that you can do this now. That will probably stay with you. I'm sure it will, later when you're an adult. So that's good that you're learning this stuff now. Before we go to some of the questions I got coming in via text here, I just want to get your take, Ellen, on what you think is going on in Muslim countries. They seem to have it down pretty good. They don't allow, as I'm sure you're aware, interest or usury, as they call it. That seems to be working quite well for them. And I also wanted to ask you if you think that might have had something to do possibly with, for example, the overthrow of Gaddafi last year.
I think it definitely had something to do with the overthrow of Gaddafi. He had a system in which the government owned the bank, the central bank, which lent to the government. So they created, put in this $33 billion water system that brought the water from the north to the south, and water, you know, basically brought water to the desert. And then he was spreading that to other African countries, setting up these systems and trying to set up an African monetary union. And what they did basically was just issue their own credit, which a government should be allowed to do. But they weren't part of the Bank for International Settlements, and so they had to be snuffed out. Well, the thing that most blatant thing he did was attempting to organize the African countries to not sell their products in dollars, but to sell them in gold dinar.
Yeah, I remember that.
Before that, you were supposed to sell your oil only in U.S. dollars. So he had to be stopped, and he was.
Sure. Yeah, that whole thing smelled very, very foul, very suspicious. And, of course, he's not alone. There's been others, too, for the same reason over the years.
Yeah, well, to even like Iraq was right before Saddam Hussein was maybe not as flamboyant, but it was the same issue where he refused to, instead of selling oil in dollars, he sold oil in euros, which was a flagrant violation of this secret deal between Henry Kissinger and the OPEC countries, where right. they were supposed to sell their oil only in dollars.
American dollars. Yeah. Well, we know it wasn't for weapons of mass destruction, that's for sure.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, did you you guys want to take some of these questions we got here?
Sure.
This one is for both of you, yeah. This one is from Avis in New Jersey. Avis asks, how does Victoria and Ellen think that we can force the government and banks to stop ripping off people?
Well, to start, I think we should start informing more people on this issue, and that's part of it so far. Ellen knows more.
Well, that's a very good answer. That's probably the first thing I would say is you have to educate people because people don't understand how the system works. That's a very good answer. What do you think, Ellen?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Of course, our thing with Public Banking Institute is that we think that the state should have state-owned banks. In other words, we should keep our revenues in our local communities and be creating credit with our money instead of sending it off to Wall Street and then paying them interest for the benefit of lending us back our money, which is the way it is today. And then they don't even lend it back. They speculate with it, et cetera.
Sure.
They do things
yeah.
that actually hurt our economies. But if you go into a supermarket with an initiative and you say, do you want to sign my petition for a state-owned bank? People won't know what you're talking about, and they won't want to do it because they don't trust government, et cetera. So the first thing you have to do is education. Like when they've had populist movements historically, they would hold, you know, picnics and meetings and classes, and they would educate themselves. And then when they had a whole group of people who understood what was really going on, that's when they could have an impact.
Yeah. It makes me think of that expression, the definition of insanity is to keep making the same mistake over and over and over and each time thinking you're going to achieve, you know, positive results.
Yeah.
If something keeps consistently failing, it's time to stop doing that and, you know, pursue a different plan of action. Well, the Federal Reserve has been failing us, and indeed all the other banks of this nature have been failing nations around the world consistently. For too long, it's time to scrap that system and develop a new one that's not based on you know, exploiting people and fattening the wallets of those at the top, because that's all we're getting.
Yeah, and the way they get away with saying they're too big to fail is that we don't have any alternative. We're sort of stuck with them. But if we develop an alternative, then we can move over into the better mousetrap and just let the old mousetrap fail.
Yeah. Anyway, we got some more questions here. Carol in Arizona asks, what is the name? Oh, I think you already covered this, but we can do it again. What is the name of your new book, and when will it be available?
The Buck Starts Here, Restoring Prosperity with Publicly Owned Banks. That's my working title, and I hope to have
so
it
far.
Available in about a month, but I'm not sure.
Maybe the European customers will have a different title, right?
Maybe so.
Hey, can I make a suggestion? Maybe you should have Victoria write the foreword or something.
Oh, that'd be great. Actually, Hazel Henderson wrote the foreword, but I could have another one.
There you go. Or the introduction or something. That would be great. Anyway, let's go to another question here. We got Patrick in Louisiana. He asks, I remember reading about a study done several decades ago, which predicted the collapse of the world economy within the next 20 years. Does Ellen foresee such a collapse if things aren't changed? And if so, how many years do we have left? Pretty fatal diagnosis.
Well, they're now talking about the fiscal cliff. I think things will collapse when they, whoever they is, decide they'll collapse. Everything is manipulated.
Sure.
It's remarkable that the stock market has stayed up when all these things are going bad. And last summer, the stock market totally collapsed when we had this debt ceiling issue. But it's all artificial. It's all arbitrary. The whole LIBOR scandal was over the fact that interest rates have been manipulated. But those are kind of small manipulations. But the big ones, the Federal Reserve blatantly manipulates interest rates and is allowing the banks to borrow from each other at 0.25%. Like, they're getting money for free, and Greece is paying 30%. So they're in control. And they've got all those things that, like interest rate swaps, that where they can make the market look different than it really is.
Yeah.
But it does look like they're pushing for a collapse, because I think the idea is if you have a crisis, then everybody goes into default and foreclosure, and then the elites pick up yet more properties, and they wind up owning everything, and we wind up slaves to the banks. I think that's the idea. But hopefully we'll see through it before it happens.
Yeah, there's a pervasive fear. I don't know if this is so much the case in other countries, but here in the U.S., people don't like the word conspiracy. You know, anytime you use that, oh, you're one of those crazy conspiracy nuts. But, you know, the whole world has always worked that way. Conspiracies are simply people who get together and come up with a way of profiteering, you know, financially, politically, or otherwise, by fooling other people and shystering them, ripping them off. And, you know, that really is the only way to describe how this system works, isn't it? I mean, what else word can you use?
Yeah, but it's a legal term. I mean, there are conspiracies, and people get convicted of conspiracy all the time. So we know it actually happens.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's why they have an advantage. If you think about it, like a populist movement, here you've got all these people with their own ideas about what's going on and what we should do, and how do we get together? Because we all respect each other's sovereignty. You know, we're not trying to force anybody to do anything. But the conspiracy theorists, those are the people behind closed doors that are actually pulling strings. And, you know, they're all like one secret force that's powerfully impacting things.
Yes, Virginia, there is a conspiracy. And, of course, as you climb that ladder, you realize, son of a gun, the same interests here are actually, you know, owning and running our media. They're responsible for the information that reaches the public. So, you know, you start putting two and two together, you realize no wonder the public doesn't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was part of the conspiracy back in the 1920s. Rockefeller and Morgan intentionally bought up the media so that they could control information.
And that's where G. Edward Griffin's book comes in. That's good for the history of it, you know, to how this, you know, conspiracy, that's what it is, how it has worked, how it's got us in this mess. And, of course, it didn't just come up in 1913. That was the outgrowth of something that was working insidiously behind the scenes going back, you know, pretty much at the beginning of this country's history.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, we have another question here. We got Elisa in California. She asks, ask Ellen, what are the obstacles for converting the successful state banking system of North Dakota to every other U.S. state? You want to elaborate on that? Well, you know, how North Dakota is working?
North Dakota is the only state that escaped the credit crisis. They have a very nice surplus, and they've had it every year since 2008. And they have a state-owned bank where they put their revenues in the state-owned bank, and then they leverage their money into credit. So they double their money, basically, which is how all banking works. The bank lends out your money at the same time that you can come for it whenever you want it. So they're double counting it, basically. So in this case, they're doing it for the benefit of the state and the people. The state gets the profits back, and they can direct their credit where the state needs it. So they're building infrastructure for... They have a booming oil business, and some people say, well, it's all about oil, and that's why they're doing well. But you've got to have the infrastructure to, even if you have resources. I mean, California has resources, and Montana has oil, just like North Dakota does, but they don't have the same credit system where they can develop the infrastructure. But what we in the Public Banking Institute, we have representatives who are trying to get legislation passed in different states. There are 18 states that have bills pending or have introduced bills of one sort or another for public banks. But the obstacles are, I think, largely that people don't understand it. And, of course, the bankers have the ear of the politicians, just like just like Wall Street owns the federal politicians. So you have your big banks are very influential in paying campaign contributions and lobbyists. And
they got their ears and their throats and everything else.
And they own the media, yeah.
Yeah, they do.
So we have to spread this information at the grassroots level, like through the Internet and to people.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can forget invading Iran and Syria. I think the next war we're looking at is an invasion of North Dakota. Wouldn't surprise me. So maybe that's the answer to this situation. It's not converting other banks to North Dakota's model. We just all need to move to North Dakota.
Well, they do have a flood of people moving in because it's the only booming economy in the country.
Sure. I'm not surprised, not the least bit surprised. You know, talking about schemes and scams, I'm sure you're aware of the Glass-Steagall Act and the role that that's played in what ultimately led to the phony bailout thing of, you know, 2008, the almost collapse. And the...
Is that a question?
Yeah, are you aware of the Glass-Steagall Act and you know, how...
Yeah, that separated investment, or it allowed commercial banks to engage in investment banking, which means that they can take our deposits and speculate, basically. But it also means the four big banks that own virtually, the four biggest banks also own 96%, I think, of the derivatives. And so they've quit making loans to local economies. They don't make much money making loans to local business, and so they've lost interest because now they're allowed to use their mighty leveraging power and credit power and the ability to borrow for almost nothing. They can use that to speculate with. So why should they bother to go into the business of lending, which is the conventional, traditional business of banking? So they've virtually abandoned what they should be doing and the thing we're supporting them for, they're not doing anymore.
Right. And there's so many things that have come out of this. You know, the housing crisis is another one.
Yeah. Collapse,
you can just go on and on. The scandals, no end. We have another question that just came in. This is from Darla in Ohio. She says, I remember Dr. Mohamed Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize for his system of microeconomics, which ended poverty in Bangladesh. And so the question is this system applicable to the U.S.? Are you familiar with his program? I guess it is.
It's his, I think. It was
Darla, is a he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Those Indian names.
It's micro lending is.
I'm looking at the person's name who gave the question, Darla. But the guy's name is Mohammed. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not awake tonight for some reason.
So it is like they still, to some extent, it was still very high interest rates. Like I think it was 18% for a real estate loan, but it's before that the people just couldn't get loans at all. They didn't have any basis for getting credit. So it allowed these little businesses, like very little businesses, to get. They would give like $50 loans or whatever to get them started, or just give them some sort of access to credit. So it still is basic. It's still a private banking system, but it's at a very local, very small level for small people just couldn't get credit. And there's actually precedent for that, like in the Middle Ages when the big banks, they were the Jewish bankers were allowed to lend when the Christians weren't. It was illegal for Christians to to go into lending. And so the Jewish bankers had a monopoly of the field, and they were charging like 60% interest. So if you were a big landlord or something, you could get credit. But the poor people just didn't have access to credit. So the monasteries started, they set up these, they were called Mons Pietatis, where they were pawn shops for the poor, where you could come in and just get a little loan just by pawning whatever you had, and they charged a very low interest rate. And in fact, at first they charged no interest, but because that was the legal approved way, but then they went bankrupt because, you know, you do have to have some sort of way to fund your business. Some people will default. They won't pay the money back. And
yeah. Always got that to be concerned about. Anyway, unfortunately, we've run out of time here, but I want to thank you for coming on, Ellen, and also, of course, Veronica, keep up the good work. Victoria, excuse me. Wow, I'm messing up tonight, getting people's names all mixed up. Yeah, great work. Keep it up. This is great. I'm looking forward, hopefully, to more videos of your speeches. That's wonderful. And hats off to your dad. He's doing a good job teaching you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You bet. It's been a really enjoyable experience having you on. So once again, folks, go check out Ellen's website. It's publicbankinginstitute.org, right?
Yep, and webofdebt.com. Thanks, Charles.
And webofdebt.com. You bet. We'll interview you again sometime. You can give us an update on your new book. But definitely go there, folks. Check out her website. You can learn more about her banking institute, and you can see get more information on Victoria and her great speeches there. Or just go to YouTube. You can check out her work. Next week, we're going to be joined by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's one of the leaders of the Occupy movement, and she'll be here to speak about health care, so you don't want to miss that. Thanks for joining us, folks, and we'll see you next week. Take care.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.